Thank you, Brother Bob. Well, we'll be served by Brother Bill Dutka this afternoon. This is the last discourse of the day, and as a reminder, if there are any questions or points which you'd like elaboration on, don't forget to submit those, because our question meeting will, or question session will be immediately following the discourse. Brother Bill has given us his subject matter, which fits well with the hymn that was just sung. Title is, You Are What You Believe. You are what you believe. Brother Bill.
Good afternoon once again, and it's been a joy to be here with everybody this weekend. And we also have another handout we want to give the brethren, so let me give that to Brother Ross. Just so everybody knows, we have to put a little plug in for our convention, which is the end of April and the beginning of May. So April 30th and May 1st is the Associated Bible Students of Metropolitan Detroit's convention, and I didn't bring any convention programs with me, so I'm sure I'll hear about that when I get back. But how many here would agree with the statement that you are what you believe? Sometimes it is hard to relate our everyday experiences or activities with our Christianity. Those who are still employed in the workforce have a daily routine and our interaction with others does not always lend itself to the opportunity of us witnessing that we are Christians. Others that are retired have a daily routine of service that has become a part of their life. The younger you are as a Christian, the more growth or development you might observe. Just because of the contrast. This doesn't mean that a full grown tree stops developing. We live in a more refined society today where honesty and integrity are expected, and people try to behave themselves and act accordingly. Thus, we go through our daily activities and we act cordial even if principles are tested. Our reaction to the situation could be so natural that we don't even see that our reaction could have been something different or out of the ordinary. Even if other people take notice that a reaction was odd, it doesn't always send out a signal that you are a Christian. For many people are not familiar with real Christian principles. One might think that you could just be a good, honest person with a high moral standard. We are going to look at an example that if our conscience is rightly exercised, this will show that we have the proper focus. Thus, one's actions dictate their resolve. So then, you are what you believe. The question then is, how do you form ideas and opinions? What is your main influence that is directing your thought? Of course, we all know the answer to this question is the Word of God. As Martin Luther said on April 18th in the year 1521 at 6 p.m., my conscience is captive to God's word, and it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. The scriptures are what educate our conscience, thus dictating our actions. But not just the scriptures, but the proper interpretation of the scriptures. So in essence, these principles shape our character, how we think, and how we act. Having or not having the proper perspective on a subject can alter the way you view it. So then, you are what you believe to be true and know. 15th century Europeans knew that the sky was made of close concentric crystal spheres rotating around a central earth and carrying the stars and the planets. That belief of knowledge structured everything they did and thought, because it told them the truth. Then Galileo's telescope changed the truth. As a result, 100 years later, everyone knew that the universe was open and infinite, working like a giant clock. Architecture, music, literature, science, economics, art, politics, everything changed, mirroring the new view created by the change in the knowledge. Today, we live according to the latest version of how the universe functions. This view affects our behavior and thought, just as previous versions affected those who lived with them. Like the people of the past, we disregard phenomena which do not fit our view because they are wrong or outdated. Like our ancestors, we know the real truth. At any time in the past, people have held a view of the way the universe works, which was for them similarly definitive, whether it was based on myth or research. At any time, that view they held was sooner or later altered or changed by the body of knowledge. Let's examine one of these present-day views in order to show that what you believe influences your behavior. We want to go back to the account of Noah right after the flood. What we know from the account of the flood is that only 8 people survived the deluge. This was Noah, his 3 sons, and all their wives, a total of 8. Then the story picks up in Genesis, the 9th chapter, with the genealogy of Noah's prodigy. So let's read Genesis 9, 18 through 29. The sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These 3 were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled or populated. Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk, and he lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his 2 brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done unto him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. The question then is from the account in verse 25, why is Canaan cursed? The answer to this question is in verse 22, "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father." We want to focus more on the question, what was this curse that was pronounced on Canaan? The answer to this question is directly related to how you think and act. There have been many answers given to this question throughout history. Let's take a look at history from the vantage point where we stand today and see what conclusions we can draw. The curse that was pronounced on Canaan in verse 25, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." To help us answer this question, let us ask, who are Canaan's brothers? Are they natural brothers of their father Ham, or brethren, Canaan's uncles, Japheth and Shem? In verse 26 and 27, seems to have the thought that his brothers are his uncles, Japheth and Shem. The word brethren is Strong's 251. It is used in the sense of family or relatives. It does not discriminate one over the other. We will look at historical evidence for our determination. What kind of slave was Canaan unto his brethren? How long was Canaan a servant of his brethren, and how was he a servant? First, let's see what Vine's Expository Dictionary of Biblical Words has to say about the definition of Strong's 5650, to serve. This noun appears over 750 times in the Old Testament. It first appears in Genesis 9:25, "A servant of servants shall Canaan be unto his brethren," meaning the lowest of slaves. A servant may be bought with money, as in Exodus 12:44, or hired as in 1 Kings 5, verse 6. Then the often repeated statement of God's redemption to Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. Deuteronomy 13, verse 5. Slavery is the mark of those called by God, as in Exodus 14, verse 31. They believed the Lord and his servant, Moses. God claimed, "For unto the children of Israel are servants." Leviticus 25, 55 and Isaiah 49, verse 3. And the Lord spoke by his servant, the prophets. 2 Kings 21, verse 10. The psalmist said, "I am thy servant." Psalm 116, verse 16, indicating the appropriateness of the title to all believers. The word servant in vines does not encompass the harsh treatment that we have associated with slavery during the 19th century. This is because the Word of God does not teach being inhumane to your fellow man. To use the word inhumane is an understatement in the context of slavery during the 19th century. The scriptural period of slavery was limited to 6 years, as in Exodus 21, verse 2, and slaves had rights and protection under the law, Exodus 21, verse 20. The phrase, "the servant of the Lord," is one of the most outstanding references to Messiah in the Old Testament, and its teachings are concentrated at the end of Isaiah, chapters 42 through 53. Therefore, a slave is one who is bound in servitude as the property of another person. Let's look at some thoughts of the past and see how verses 25 and 26 in Genesis 9 have been interpreted. Verse 25 and 26 again. He said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." The interpretation of many would be that the curse here consists of being in servitude, an inferior position of the most abject kind. This imposed inferiority of the self-willed slave owners tends more and more to all the horrid ills of slavery, man's inhumanity to man. The slavery we know originated in war and conquest. The mere warrior put the captives to death. The cannibal devoured them. The economist fed them for their labor. Accordingly, slavery soon made its appearance in all countries which were trodden by the conqueror. A system of slavery imposed without consent and for no crime is a dire evil. Besides the direct injustice of robbing a fellow man of his personal liberty, it dissolves wedlock and breaks the family tie and disregards the conscience. It trades, therefore, in the souls of mankind. It is a historical fact that the degradation of slavery has fallen especially upon the race of Ham. As we look at history, we can see that a portion of the Canaanites were bondsmen among the Israelites, who were therefore of the race of Shem. The early Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Egyptians, who all belonged to the race of Ham, were subjugated by the Assyrians, who were Shemites. Then we have the Persians, the Macedonians, and the Romans, who were all Japhethites, who traded in slaves. In modern times, it is well known that most of the nations of Europe traded in African slaves. It has been said that the servile tribe is also the most tyrannical. And it is a fact that the Africans have lent themselves to the forcible seizing and selling into slavery in distant lands of their own kinsmen and fellow countrymen. Of course, without a demand, you would not have a market. As we look at history, this curse pronounced by Noah on Canaan was man's justification for slavery of the most degraded kind that man has experienced. and justified by those who traded in it, just because of their interpretation of these verses and their self-will. Just a side note, Denmark was the first European country to abolish the slave trade in the year 1792. England's Parliament abolished West Indian slave trade in 1833 and slavery in Jamaica in 1838. And on January 1, 1863, Abraham Lincoln declared that all slaves within any state or designated part of a state then in rebellion shall be thenceforward and forever free. It wasn't until 1865 that slavery was abolished in the United States. And when we were in Ghana, we visited the Cape Coast Castle that exported slaves, and it was interesting to note from their literature that that slavery at the Cape Coast Castle was stopped in the year 1874. Is this what Noah had in mind when he pronounced this curse? What kind of man was Noah? Better yet, what did God think of Noah? Let's read Genesis 6, verses 8 and 9. But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. From vines we get the thought that Noah was a righteous or just man, in the sense of loyalty to God. He would have been in harmony with God and his plans and purposes, and would not have done anything out of harmony or displeasing to the Creator. Noah was a patriarch. This is testified in him being selected to build the ark in Genesis 6, verses 14 and 22. Let's read Genesis, the sixth chapter, verses 14 and 22. Make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. In verse 22, Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. So then, how was this curse executed on Canaan? We know from Genesis 9:19 that the earth was populated from these eight. And this is from the Amplified, Genesis 9, verse 19. These are the three sons of Noah, and from them the whole earth was overspread and stocked with inhabitants. Let's take a moment and look at the descendants of Noah's sons. The three distinct ethnic groups that came from Noah's sons are Shem, the Semitic people, including the Hebrews, Ham, the Hamitic tribes, and this would be the Ethiopians, Egyptians, some Arabians, and the African tribes. And then Japheth historically was the progenitor of the Aryan or Indo-European or Indo-Germanic branch of the human family. This prophecy or curse pronounced on Canaan by Noah is fulfilled in that the Canaanite was always dominated by either one of his two uncles, the Shemites or Japhethite. A portion of the Canaanites became bondsmen among the Israelites, who were of the race of Shem. The early Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, and Egyptians, who all belonged to the race of Ham, were subjugated by the Assyrians, who were Shemites. The Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Egyptians, who all belonged to the race of Ham, were all subjugated by the Assyrians, who were Shemites. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 49, we see an example of how the Semitic people, or the Hebrews in particular, had the race of the Canaanites subjected to them. Let's read Deuteronomy 32, verse 49. Deuteronomy 32, 49. Ascend this mountain of the Abram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab across from Jericho, and view the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites for a possession. When God gives something to you or takes something away from you and gives it to another, you don't question the wisdom of the Creator, although you might not understand His purpose. The Canaanites became subservient to the Shemites. For Shem came Abraham, and from Abraham ultimately the 12 tribes of Israel, who were given the land of Canaan, as we just read in Deuteronomy 32, verse 49. Let's look at another question that seems to have perplexed skeptics as well as believers. How were the races created? We know that in Adam, God incorporated the entire human gene pool. The Apostle Paul, on his sermon on Mars Hill, or before the Areopagus, states in Acts 17, verse 26, from one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth. And he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of their places where they would live. Once again, through Noah and his wives and his sons' wives, the entire gene pool of all the nations existed of a pure Adamic race. The question then is, how did the variety of races come into existence? We believe that in the confounding of the languages during the building of the Tower of Babel, God not only separated the human race by languages, but also by dominant genes. In God's design, he separated the races by languages and gene pool at the same time. He paired up the dominant genes with the same language to create different races, thus separating the people outwardly by language and inwardly, unknown to the couples, by dominant genes to produce his desired result. Let's read Genesis 11, 1 through 9. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as they migrated from the east, they came upon the plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord said, look, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their languages there, so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. How many can remember high school biology and Mendel's Law? Mendel was an Austrian monk who published his work on the patterns of inheritance in different pea plant varieties in the year 1866. The science of genetics began in the year 1900, when several plant breeders independently discovered his works. Mendel suggested that each parent has pairs of these units, but contributes only one unit from each pair to its offspring. These units were later given the names genes. God destroyed the Tower of Babel and confused the tongues to separate the people, and in addition to separating the people into nations, he separated them into races. Today we have approximately 5,000 languages, 50 to 200 unrelated stocks that trace back to about 2500 BC, roughly the time of the Tower of Babel. Biologists who predict distribution of genetic information use the Punnett square. With divine wisdom and intervention, within two generations, you can have all the races from the blackest black to the whitest white. If you were to let all the races marry for a length of time, you would eventually end up with one race, just like Adam, because of the dominant genes. This would be the same race that was dispersed with the confounding of the languages. This also is the direction that the U.S. demographics are headed, one big melting pot. Let's read Genesis 9:23. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it on both their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Shem and Japheth, out of respect, took a garment and, not looking, covered their father's nakedness. In Genesis 9:26, how is blessed by the Lord my God be Shem fulfilled? This means that, in a particular sense, God would be identified as the God of Shem, through whom Messiah would come for human redemption. This is the patriarch designation of Shem. This is the prophetic designation of Shem as the patriarch through whom Jesus would be born. Let's look at Genesis 9:27. What is meant by, may God make space for Japheth and let him live in the tents of Shem? Let's read a couple translations here. The first one is the King James, Genesis 9:27. God shall enlarge Japheth. In the New Revised Standard Version, may God make space for Japheth. And then in the NAS, may God enlarge Japheth. And in the NIV, may God extend the territory of Japheth. This prophesied the multiplication of his posterity, which was remarkably fulfilled in the prolification of the populations of Europe and other places where the so-called Western civilization prevailed. What is meant in verse 27, and let him live in the tents of Shem? Depending upon the word him in this passage, it either refers to God or Japheth. The two various interpretations have been proposed. The more humorous view is that the Caucasians shall live in the tents of Shem. It is said to be fulfilled and that most of the Japhethites pay rent to Jewish landlords. We do not think this is what the text is referring to. In fact, this kind of interpretation leads to what we first discussed about the idea of slavery. It leads to division and prejudice. We think that he here refers to God, not Japheth. He, God, shall dwell in the tents of Shem, another reference to the spiritual blessings upon Israel through the messianic line. The participation of the Japhethites in the sharing of the blessings of the Shemites, what exclusively started out to be God's dealings with the Jew, ended up that the Gentiles are grafted in, and eventually all the families of the earth will receive God's blessings. Many changes were brought about by the flood. In Genesis 9:2, it tells us that the first time that animals feared man. And in Genesis 9:3, that animals could now be killed for meat. And in Genesis 9:21, we are informed that food and drink would spoil. Noah had not expected this. Let's read Genesis 9:1-3. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth and on every bird of the air, on everything that creeps on the ground and on all flat fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And just as I have given the green plant, I give you everything. Let us make a suggestion here that Noah, not expecting the changes that occurred to cause fermentation of fruit juice, became intoxicated and fell asleep. In conclusion, you are what you believe. Let's look at Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verses 16 and 21. Zechariah 14, verse 16. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths, Or in the NIV, it says the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, let's just keep reading here, right through 21. And it will be that whichever of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King of the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up on either, up or enter, then no rain will fall on them. It will be the plague which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Verse 19. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. In that day there will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar. Then verse 21. And every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judea will be holy to the Lord of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil in them. And there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. The Feast of Tabernacles followed closely the Day of Atonement. Both took place in the seventh month, one on the 10th and the other on the 15th of Tishri. What the seventh day or Sabbath was in reference to the week, the seventh month seems to have been in reference to the year. It closed not only the sacred cycle, but also the agricultural or working year. It also marked the change of seasons, the approach of rain, and of the winter equinox, and determined alike the commencement and close of the sabbatical year. This, the Feast of Tabernacles, followed 5 days after the Day of Atonement, in which the sin of Israel had been removed and its covenant relation with God restored. Thus a sacrificed nation could keep a holy feast of harvest, joy unto the Lord. Just as in the truest sense it will be in that day when the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles shall be a reality fulfilled. Notice in the reading of Deuteronomy 16, verses 13 through 17, the festival of booths is reviewed. The three specially marked events are the festival of tabernacles, its joyous festivals, the dwelling in booths, and the sacrifices and rites of the week. The first of these was simply characteristic of the Feast of Ingathering, nor were any in Israel to appear before the Lord empty. So let's read Deuteronomy 16, 13 through 17. You shall keep the Feast of Booths for 7 days, when you have gathered in the produce from your threshing floor and from your winepress. Rejoice during your festival, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and female slaves, as well as the Levite, the stranger, the orphan, and the widow resident in your towns. 7 days you shall keep the festival to the Lord your God at the place that the Lord will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all your undertaking, and you shall surely celebrate. Verse 16. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God at the place that you will choose, at the festival of unleavened bread, at the festival of weeks, and at the festival of booths. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. All shall give as they are able, according to the blessings of the Lord your God that he has given you. The festival of tabernacles represented the millennial age. What is meant in verse 21, and there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day? The Canaanite people were idolatrous and immoral people. So then, by not having any more a Canaanite around would represent total fidelity to God. Man will, in the millennial age, purge himself of all impurities of thought, thus making his actions perfect in accordance with how God intended man to be from the beginning. Thus the created will be able to worship the Creator. Let us close with the reading of Revelation 22, verse 5. And there will no more, and there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they shall reign forever and ever. This is in reference to those in the millennial age. The nature of the reign then will be delivered to the world. It will be the same reign or kingdom which at its creation was bestowed upon Father Adam, as it is written in Psalms 8, 6 through 8.
Thank you, Brother Bill. And as a final reminder, because we've reached the end of the day in terms of discourses, are there any questions that any of the brethren would like to submit? Because I haven't received any of this. This is a first. Maybe we'll let the three brothers off the hook this year. Oh, I see one hand. So let me go retrieve that question. We might as well address this one since it was on Brother Bill's talk, and it's a very, I don't know if it's a simple one or not, but there is the comment here. What is a Red Republican?
Oh.
This list on page 2 is something I took out of Christian History magazine. And it was all the reasons for slavery. In fact, the first note here is why Christians should support slavery. And, of course, these were questions back during, you know, the Civil War, right before the Civil War, that were questions between the North and the South. And, of course, these questions came about because of what the scriptures or what they thought the scriptures were to teach about this. Just a little bit about what happened during the Civil War. The most... The land was probably the most valuable to the slave owner, and second was the slave. So, of course, you know, the slave owner didn't want to give up his way of making a living. And so the Red Republicans down here would be all these lists here. Are the one the political reason? This was a group, and these were those that would be, you know, against the idea of the slavery. You know, it says Christians are to obey civil authorities, and those authorities permit and protect slavery. And then those that would be opposed would be all these different groups: the atheists, the socialists, the communists, and then there was another group there, the Red Republicans. So hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you. What I would suggest we do, since we do not have any further questions, is we'll close with the two verses, the last three, verses 3 and 4 of Brother Bill's choice, which was hymn number 311. And then we'll just say a few words, and then we'll have a closing hymn. And we can then be on our way.
Oh.
as each year rolls by, the faces change a little bit. We all get a little older, but we're thankful that we as the Rockland class have been able to provide you with this day of spiritual refreshment. We trust that the discourses have been a blessing to you and that they'll provoke you to further good works. And we, of course, owe our thanks to a number of brethren that have helped us in the past, and Brother Dick and Sister Beverly, thank you, Sister Beverly Lally, and their effort with regard to the book table. We really appreciate that a great deal. And, of course, the DeVicos, we always count on them for the recording service, the sisters, Sister Marilee, Sister Julie, in connection with the hymn playing, and then Brother Obie, and, of course, those that served on the platform. So, again, Brother Randy, also, for leading our song service, and we'll ask that he come up again and deliver the lead us in the last hymn, which is going to be hymn number 66 in the Sweet By and By, and then we'll close with prayer, and we'll ask Brother Bill Dutka to do that for us.